Living in a world where the threat is constantly evolving and changing is challenging. Finding the technology and capabilities to meet and defeat those threats in a timely manner can sometimes prove twice as daunting. But for one team at Program Executive Office Land Systems, those challenges do not deter them, but rather energizes and drives them to find creative solutions for the Marines who face those threats daily. They are the men and women of the newest program team at PEOLS, the Ground-Based Air Defense Team, also known as GBAD. They're quickly making a name for themselves, not only for the diverse capabilities that they will be fielding, but also for the speed in which they are getting that gear in the hands of Marines. It is indeed a pleasure and a privilege to have a conversation with the program manager for GBAD, Mr. Don Kelly. Before we get started, some truth in advertising. Don and I go back a few years, probably too many to count. But long before we found ourselves on the PEO staff, we met on the baseball fields, coaching and watching our kids grow up. So I may be a bit biased during this conversation, but I did tell him that I will not be asking any softball questions, only fastballs and sliders. So, Don, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Listen, before we get started, we dive down into this conversation about your GBAD world. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up on this acquisition team of ours.
Well, I was California born in Bakersfield, Utah raised, got my education at the University of Utah, got a Bachelor of Science in Political Science, and was in the Navy ROTC, and ended up in 7th Fleet as a surface warfare officer on cruisers and destroyers. I was part of the Clinton drawdown, ended up in industry working on combat systems for carriers for Hughes Aircraft Company, and then they were bought out by Raytheon, left them for a small company and came out to the East Coast, and then was asked to be an acquisition professional by NAVC up there in D.C. and worked on the cooperative engagement capability. Okay. And then Dr. Burrow called me one day and says, what about coming working for the Marine Corps?
Our former executive
Your
director.
Your former executive director, correct.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I came down here and was put on the USMC crew program as their team lead and eventually their deputy program manager. They then asked me to go over there to be their product director mm-hmm. for phase two. Went over there. It ended up as the deputy program manager of what they call AC2SN. Air Command and Control and Sensor Netting program as their deputy, and then was asked to be the deputy, the chief of staff for the PEO. And long behold, they stood up PMG BAD and left chief of staff and became the program manager there about 4 years ago.
Awesome. A lot of great things happening. Obviously, I've had the opportunity to see some of the great work that your team is doing. Can you just give us a little breakdown of your team and some of the efforts that you're undertaken here in the last couple of years?
When we stood up, originally we had two areas of focus. One was mobile systems and the other one was fixed sites. Very shortly, we ended up with a third focused area, which included MRIC. So what we have now is three PDMs. The mobile systems, or what we call the future weapon systems, are putting counter UAS systems on the MRAZRs or the ULTV, ultralight tactical vehicles that are right. under development with Marcor Syscom. They're putting a counter UAS system on there. Also, the Future Weapon System 1 does the same thing, take basically the same components, but they're on a JLTV. And then we add the Stinger on what they call an air-to-air launcher. We're putting that on top of the Stinger on the remote weapon station. So it also has a fixed wing and rotary wing capability to counter those threats. And then we have what we call fixed sites. Fixed site is for installations, basically. Okay. And so we're using a system right now that's developed by Anduril as a service at the moment. And we're checking out to see if we can go for installations to provide a counter UAS capability as a service, vice going out and actually buying the equipment and that. And then the last area is what we call our MRIC system, medium range intercept capability.
Okay.
This one's pretty interesting. We took the CAC2S, the Common Aviation Command and Control System that is the Marine Corps C2 system or Command and Control System. We took the Gator radar, the Ground Air Task Oriented Radar, mm-hmm. and then we also took components from Iron Dome. specifically their battle management control. This is where their fire control algorithms right. are. And we took their Tamir missile and uplink, and we integrated those together. And this last year has been pretty exciting there. We've had two live fires where been highly successful and increasing in capability. And we got one more that even takes it even further to see if we can get to our objective requirements. Yeah. As the team, we've gone from a total of 12 government and civilian guys to where now we're approximately a little over, I think we're around 55 government and civilian personnel running all those programs as we move forward.
So let me slow you down because you just threw a whole lot of stuff at me.
Yes, I did.
And it's going to take me several shows to unpack all of this. So let's start at the beginning. So if I could just take you back in time a little bit when you stood up this team. Obviously, we're doing a lot of neat stuff. And you're not necessarily, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned the fact that you're looking at capabilities potentially as a service. So from my perspective, I think one of the things that's unique about what you're doing is you're capitalizing on currently existing systems, correct?
That is correct. What I tell our team and I tell our stakeholders is we don't develop anything at GBAT in our program office. What we do is we take existing products. Most of them are TLR 8 or 9. Okay. Sometimes we'll drop down to 6 or 7, depending on what the component is. And then we integrate them together. It's not easy, but it's a different skill set. We have to ensure that what we integrate is open architect, that we have access to all the interfaces, so we make all the ones and zeros talk to each other.
Right.
And then we play like we do a lot of things like what the guys in NAVAIR do on airplanes. We watch weight and CG, power, to make sure that we can get all this equipment on these vehicles, on the vehicle side, to ensure that we don't exceed our weight requirements, don't exceed the power requirements that the vehicle provides. And that's where the real challenge is.
So unlike having a solid requirement that says X, Y, and Z, you're actually evolving the thing. You're evolving the requirement and evolving the capability. Is it fair to say you're making things go faster?
Want to correct one thing. I do have requirements.
Okay.
I have a CDD. The issue is that the CDD says counter UASs.
Okay.
Where it's changing is the threat's changing. So we are very in tune, and we do on a very regular basis gifts with the Marine Corps Intelligence Agency and understand where the threat's going.
Right.
So what that does is it drives where we may utilize a specific component. And then as we move forward, as we get the threat updates, we may find that component's become obsolete, that it's no longer countering the threat. So therefore, we have to then very proactively look for other components that can counter that threat and then integrate it into our system real time. So whereas other programs have requirements, they set it up, they kind of can deal with it for 10 to 15 years. Our capability has a shelf life that is determined not by what is the latest out there, but determined by where the threat goes, specifically in this counter UAS world.
Got it.
So that's the slight difference.
I'm not
creating requirements as I go. That all comes from CD&I, but the threat is driving us to where we have to go on these platforms.
That's incredible. So, and again, you mentioned your team's been stood up for what, 4 years?
Four years. We stood up in August of 18.
So how big was that team when you started?
Was it 18? 12. 12 people. It was me and a few guys that we got from the Gator program office.
Okay.
They were doing at the time, the A-Man pads program.
Right.
And so we had to take those 12 guys and figure out how to maximize that. And then over the last 4 years, the PEO, the Program Executive Office for Land Systems and Marine Corps Systems Command has helped us gain personnel to bring them over. And they've been very good at making sure that we're able to get the personnel we need to at least get the product out the door.
So I got to ask, I mean, a lot of stuff, and I know I mentioned this a couple of times, we're unpacking a lot of things. What were some of your early challenges?
Our assumptions. So when
assumptions of the threat and, or assumptions
of more of the solution. Technology and the solutions that we were utilizing.
Yeah.
So before we stood up the program office, at the time, Major Lee was working under Gator. It was him and like two other guys. And what they did was they heavily leveraged what the Army was doing. The Army is different from the Marine Corps. Everyone says, hey, it's the same requirement, counter, same thing. The delta is in the Army, they're allowed to be very heavy. They're putting their capabilities on strikers. They can put a lot of stuff on there. We're putting our stuff on JLTVs and M-Razors and now the ultralight tactical vehicle. And so we have to trade capability, size, and power to beat the threat, but still be within the requirements or the capability of the individual vehicles.
Right.
So the biggest assumption that we had that hurt us the first time was we were going after a remote weapon station, a turret.
Mm-hmm.
When we got the turret, we were tracking it, but it actually came in significantly heavier than mm-hmm. anticipated. When we set it on the JLTV for the first time, I thought the tires were going to blow. It was much more heavier than we thought, so we had to go back. And one of the things that delayed the Mattis a little bit was we had to go recompete for a turret that met our weight requirements and that and within our power. So those are the kind of things that got us. So as we moved forward, we had assumptions that something was going to work. And then as we got, because we're moving so fast, sometimes we get there and we find out it didn't quite work as we thought it would. And then we'd have to rapidly refigure it out and then bring it in. And so we've gotten over most of those original assumptions. Right now we're moving very rapidly through the Mattis. We're currently in testing.
Mm-hmm.
This week we started the training with actual Marines. And it's a 7-week training because we're bringing so much capability on the JLTV. There's 35 actual days of training for the Marines before we actually go into what we call the system verification test or developmental test with the Marines operating the system in November.
Got it. Let's talk about those Marines a little bit, because you actually a nice segue into the operating forces. Who are those Marines that you're currently training?
So currently we're training 3rd LAD and 2nd
LAD.
Okay, so
the LAD battalion. So the LAD
battalion. So we are utilizing the LAD battalion.
Okay.
Aviation, Deputy Commandant for Aviation and his team are working mm-hmm. with CD&I. They've already laid out a plan to increase the manpower at the LADs to support the equipment that we're, or to operate and maintain the equipment we're giving them. We're working with CD&I to ensure that we understand exactly what's in the CDD, and they help us have the advocacy between the two of them to get the Marines out to the training that will then have the equipment. And then as soon as we get through the OT and at the end of 23, early 24, at the latest, we'll then be able to go deliver to the various LAD units, the MLRs and so
right,
forth.
Right.
And they're making the list now of exactly which units will actually get the equipment first.
So I know your team's doing a lot of work, but what's the interaction with the op forces and what role they play?
Yeah, we're talking to them all the time. So
yeah.
They have their MAC CSC, which I'm part of, so at the 06 level. I go to those every quarter.
Okay.
We have the working group, the LAD working group that my deputy and my team goes to every quarter with them. We are probably talking to the LAD battalions at the senior enlisted level and at the let's say the 03 level and below.
Okay.
On a regular basis with our PDMs and that of understanding the challenges they're having. And then we also, which I have not mentioned yet, is we're also responsible for the current A-man pad system. The current system is out there, so we're also working with them at the same time, maintaining all of that. So we are very proactive with the Marines. If we're not talking to them weekly, we're talking to them twice a week. It's just amazing how much time we spend talking to the Marines to make sure we understand what they have and make sure they understand when we're coming and what we need. And so far, every time we've required Marines for any testing or working groups or validation of tactical manuals, that so far every time they've provided exactly what we required and we're able to get that. So we're very in tune with the Marines across the board.
Well, and again, I may be stating the obvious, but at the end of the day, I mean, you and your engineers can come up with all kinds of great ideas, but if the Marines don't feel that it's the capability that they can employ or use when needed, it's not going to make a whole lot of sense.
Absolutely agree. So this is our first test with the Mattis.
Okay.
We're training them, like I said, starting this week. Next month, I'm going to go out there before the training's over. I'm going to find out what they think of the training.
Okay.
And see what we need to do different there, and then find out what are the issues they're seeing with the system.
Right.
So that we have time between the OA and the operational test to potentially make corrections so that it is right. a more conducive to what they need to do to fight the war.
So let's focus a little bit, and I know you've had connectivity with the other services and whatnot. How engaged or involved are you? You mentioned the Army earlier. Are you involved with the other services as a whole? And
absolutely.
To what extent?
Absolutely. So I probably talked to Colonel Lunoff, who's PM Shield down in Army in Huntsville under their PEO Missiles in Space at least once or twice a month. I recently had a conversation with them yesterday, or 2 days ago, matter of fact, where we're in the process of doing our POM 25 papers for what they call Stinger replacement. So it's the next generation, or what's going to replace the current Stingers out there over the next 5 to 6 years. So I had a discussion with them. What is their plan? Because we'll be the following service. And then how do we POM to be able to become part of that program, so when they go to deliver the Stinger replacement, we're able to take those, and we're in Stink, save the Marine Corps lots of money, because we'll leverage the operational assessments and the operational tests they do with our personnel in there, and have MCATIA work with their test community. For the MATIS system, we watch each other's programs. Okay. We look and see which components. We have some similar components or identical components. We have some different. Again, that's right. Usually driven by the swap that we have deals, the size, weight, and power. Okay. And then right now we're very involved with them with what we have provided to Ukraine and the what we call the replenishment of correct. Stingers. And so they have the contract for that. And so we are part of their team, making sure we understand when we'll get our missiles rebuilt by Raytheon to replenish what we gave up to the current effort that's in Ukraine.
Okay. So obviously you do a lot of this work with all our sister services and whatnot. At the end of the day, we don't get anything without an industry building something for us. What's your relationship like with industry? How involved or engaged are you with industry as they develop capabilities?
Before I answer that question, I want to go back. It's not just the Army we're engaged with. From a counter U.S. standpoint, we're also engaged with the Joint Capabilities Office.
Okay.
The engineering agent that was set up a couple years ago to oversee the counter UAS for DOD. So that has all four services. Okay. In our MRIC program, we know that the Air Force is watching what we're doing on MRIC. They're very interested. The UCOM guys are very interested. We also don't just work with the DOD. We deal with Homeland Security, some of the other three letter services.
Right.
So what I guess what I'm trying to say is from a relations standpoint, we talk to all kinds of people, all kinds of agencies, the other services all the time, and right. we understand what each other's doing. Going back to industry, our relationship is different than I think most program offices. Most program offices go out and they hire an integrator to do it all for them. So they'll hire a Boeing or a Northrop Grumman or a Raytheon. We've done things slightly different in this program. So it's made it harder on my contracting team and my acquisition team. But what we do is we figure out what is the right component for the threat. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we deal with lots of contractors. So I have a different contractor for the optic. I have a different contractor for the radar. I have a different contract for the jammer. I have a different contract that's providing the Stinger ATOL. I got a different contractor for the RWS. And so what we do is we have multiple contracts, different types of contracts. Some are OTA, some are traditional, FAR-based contracts. And so my team is actually the integrator. What does that do? One, it actually puts the competition out there for more to play.
Right.
Also, it lets them know that if their component, it also provides us the capability to shift out the component very rapidly if the threat evolves to a point where whatever the component is no longer meeting the need. I have good relationships, I believe, with most of them. It's the standard conflict of interest sometimes between the industry and the government. Probably the biggest challenge with industry is that if I was to go the traditional route, and I don't care which big company or small company you pick, we would not be able to shift out things as fast as we are today. I don't believe we could integrate it as fast as we are today. Because it's just natural, and it's the way it is. If I was with a company, and we noticed we needed to change out whatever the component is, they're going to drive you to the component they want it to be, not necessarily which actually ensures we're taking care of the threat, which is our higher priority. So that is the relationship is good, but I'm not going to say it's at times could be contentious only from the fact that they want more of the business. They want to have it all, one company, where I've spread it out over 5 to 6 different companies. And then my team is the integrators, not the industry.
So are you finding that a lot of your niche capability that you might be looking for is out there with those smaller companies working on something that's unique that may may bring a solution to the table.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So we used a small company for the jammer.
Right.
The optic company was a small company until they were bought out. Now it's a bigger company, and so forth. So I would argue it provides, I'll put it this way, it probably provides a much better opportunity for the smaller companies to get the opportunity, you know, when we go out to compete these items and that. And then we also buy a lot of things through DLA. So if it's already out there existing, it's within the DLA system, that's another way we can speed up. We can go buy it through DLA. Now I'm just buying the component, and then I have to set up, if needed, potentially repair capability as we move forward, or software updates under small individual contracts for those companies.
So I just want to hone in on something you said. So your team is actually doing the integration and whatnot, but I just want to make sure that people understand that we're not here at Syscom sitting in our office trying to integrate this stuff. I'm assuming you're working with the labs.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, yes, we are. So
Don Kelly and his team sitting in the conference room, putting all this stuff together.
No, it's not quite how it works. We're managing the interfaces from a software standpoint, hardware, but we are leveraging very heavily our labs. So, for example, the Mattis system, we are utilizing NIWIC down in Charleston.
Okay.
Charleston is currently doing the hardware integration of all the components onto the JLTV.
Okay.
We are utilizing Dahlgren from a software standpoint. So we take all the different softwares from the components. They go to Dahlgren. We've set up a lab where we test it and make sure everything's working. And then we end up with our image, our software, that then sent to go on to the various servers within the different platforms. Crane has the what will be the ultra light
Crane
tactical
out in Indiana.
In Indiana, okay. Crane, Indiana. Okay. That field activity is actually doing the integration on our smaller platform. Originally the MRazor, now it's to the ultralight tactical vehicle, the UTV. So they're doing that effort. So we got NIWIC doing the JLTV version, Crane, Indiana doing the ULTV version, Dahlgren in the middle helping us with the software integration, making sure it's working before we send it out for test, or eventually here after we get beyond the urgent needs. But the program of record, we deliver those, the software before delivering. We utilize Port Hueneme for logistics support. So
you're literally covering the entire spectrum.
We've got
California now. We went from Charleston to Indiana, and now you're in California.
And Dahlgren. And we're not hesitant to go to other field activities. We find out they have a niche that we need. So, like I said, we're utilizing across the board.
That's awesome. Great to hear. Let me ask you one other area, because we rely a lot on our partners, whether it's industry, whether it's our small businesses, large business partners. How about our international partners, our allies and partners around the world? Do you do any? Do you have any conversations or engagement? I know you mentioned Iron Dome. I believe an Israeli system. Have you done anything else with some of our other partners?
So some of the other things we've done, and I'll get back to the Iron Dome components.
Mm-hmm.
I have briefed at a couple of counter UAS conferences. In those conferences, there's usually international partners in there, typically NATO. They, after the meeting, of course, they all want to come up and ask how the Marine Corps is doing it and that. We have a good reputation of actually putting the equipment out there that works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had those conversations. Those have not gone where we have taken components from them yet, but we're watching them. We have not done any foreign military sales yet, but that is due to the fact that I am trying to get this completed. And then at that stage, and probably within the next year or so, and we're already starting to have all kinds of conversations with them on foreign military sales of getting out there. But probably the biggest relationship is with IMDO, the Israeli Missile Defense Organization. We are working with them, and their prime integrator, or their prime contractor, who is Rafael. As part of EMRIC, Rafael is providing the what we call the mini BMC, or the Battle Management Control System, which has the fire control algorithms we're using. And then they also provide the Tamir missile. The Tamir missile has a great history of being high capability with high probability of kills for certain targets.
Right.
We have a very close relationship, and in this case, through Raytheon, who's the prime on the MRIC right now, the integration to provide their capability as we integrated into the CAC2S and into the Gator components and that. So Probably the biggest partner is Israel through the IMDO and Rafael by as a subcontractor through Raytheon.
So I got to tell you, I've had a lot of folks on the show and they mentioned a lot of industries and companies and partners and all that. But I got to give it to you, Don. I think you've just mentioned more in this show than they've all had put together. So you're involved in a lot of things with a lot of people. Let me ask you, and I think there's goodness in that because you're really the breadth and depth of technology you're reaching out there to. You've used OTAs, other transaction authorities, and I believe you've also capitalized on some MTAs
as
well. All right. So
we're not afraid of any acquisition.
So that's really the road that I'm going down. How have those authorities benefited you, and you see goodness in going down those roads?
I don't believe we could have gone as fast without some of these authorities. So we have everything in the program office. We've done the regular DFAR contracts where we've competed it. We've done FAR contracts that were sole sourced, the ATOL, for example, only one company does it. Mm-hmm. We have done a OTA, other transactional authority, to get our RWS. And we were
remote weapon stations,
okay. Correct, the turret.
Yeah.
And that one, we were the first ones in MARC or CISCOM to take that from an OTA prototype and turn it into an OTA production contract.
Oh, okay.
So we were the first ones to do that. We've also used what they call a 2373, where you go one time buy a component for testing only. Mm-hmm. And so we have done that. We've done the traditional acquisition ACAT-2 program for MATIS, or the Future Weapon System, ACAT-4T for the L-MATIS, the light MATIS that'll be on the ULTV. And then we've also done the middle tier acquisition prototyping, or rapid prototyping. We utilize that approach with the MREC program. Mm-hmm. And we have our last FireX here very soon, within the next couple of weeks. And then there will be a decision to continue that prototype, rapid prototyping, to get it certified for deployment. And pending a decision in 24, early 25, we are looking at possibly moving that to a middle tier acquisition rapid fielding approach, pending on decisions and how the test and that go. And then finally, as we alluded to earlier, on the installation counter small UAS, we are looking at the services pathway, which has been briefed all the way up to the OSD level. Mm-hmm. On our approach there. And they're watching to see how we plan on pulling that off, because there is a, depending on how that all works out, there could end up being, in the end state, a whole different way of going to get some systems specifically for CONUS is right. How we're looking at it. Get systems that we never buy, so we never have to buy them. But what we do is we have the ability to sustain them and have our Marines or the security forces operate them, government employees operate the system. And you can, and that way the investment in that is really on the industry to do that. But we're taking a bath right now, truly understanding what that all means. That's where we're leaning, but that decision hasn't been fully made yet on the surface.
And I would venture to say there's probably a lot of benefits to, as industry evolves that technology, it's on them to upgrade it and do all these things.
Correct. So you would expect that
a different mindset of doing business, but perhaps the right mindset.
It could be. We're gonna find out very rapidly. We're gonna find out.
So I gotta ask the question: how do you keep your contracting officers straight? Which way are they going?
So I'm a lucky guy. I got the greatest team in the world.
Okay.
As I tell everybody, we're the best of the best of the best of the best.
All right.
We have lots of conversations. So we don't communicate with each other. We have conversations. They come in and we talk about it. We lay out the plan. We're very, what I call, schedule driven. Mm-hmm. So we spend a lot of time planning out the schedule, understanding what all the steps are. And then as we go through, we hit a physics problem, if it's technical, or a bureaucratic problem because it's contractual, or a legal problem, or whatever it might be, we then go attack that problem. So we go to the next step. So we're very proactive. The contracting officers, I've got a very robust contract team. Jahani and that group has really provided us a team. I probably got a compared to some of the other program offices, I probably got more contracting specialists than they do. That's one place where I have the right amount to get the work done. And I got a very good PCO. She understands all this stuff, and she's always coming in and telling me, you know, if we take this approach, which I may never have heard of before,
right.
We go do it. Because I never heard of a 2373 until she came and talked to me. We're trying to figure out how to do something quicker. Says, well, if we do it for just this, we can use that authority.
So it's got to be exciting for them to know that they can come in and dabble in different areas of their field rather than come in and every time just do the same contract over and over again.
Absolutely. So in our program office, we have the philosophy is I'm the dumbest guy in the room. They come in. My door is always open. They come in and tell me what we think we ought to go do. We talk about it. Sometimes we do it. Sometimes we don't. And I think that's part of our success is I have truly empowered all competencies at all levels within our program office. Nobody has a bad idea. I'm always surprised where the best idea comes from. And it's sometimes the best technical idea does not necessarily comes from your technical team. Sometimes it comes from your executive assistant sitting out there who's just hearing a lot of stuff. It's happened.
Yeah.
And so we try to be very open. We're very transparent across the entire team. And everybody owns it. They know they understand the mission. The mission's number one, get the gear to the Marines.
So let me ask you about an area that I'm sure you're intimately involved with, and that is our relationship on with Congress. Obviously, they have a vested interest in all the things that you're doing, and we obviously need their support to continue to do things to meet our missions. How involved or engaged are you with keeping folks briefed on the Hill?
Obviously, I do the mid-years.
Correct.
With the professional staffers. Since we've had some successful tests with MREC, specifically medium range intercept capability, I have briefed approximately four or five different congressmen or senator staffs, specifically their chiefs of staff, on it. I think that it is helping us when we put in our budget, the president's budget, that they are supporting it and not marking us. We have had times where we probably haven't executed to the actual line where we had to be, or we were slightly behind either in RDT and expenditures or maybe obligations. We have had limited marks since the start of this program. They are very supportive of what we're doing. They always ask me what they can do to help me go faster. I don't know how I can go much more faster than I am now, but we are always looking at ways to make that happen. I would say that I think we have a very good relationship with them. To date, it's always been supportive.
And again, it's critical for them to understand where you're going.
Yep, and I think my philosophy is I just tell them how it is. This is where we're at. This is what we've seen. And I make sure they understand, you know, I don't go up there and do rainbows and unicorns with them. I go up there and say, this is where we're at. This was very successful. Right. Hey, we did have an issue there or here, so that they understand, you know, the challenges that we're still trying to get over to get to the final product. So I would say we have a very good relationship with Congress at this stage across the board.
So a lot of things over the last 4 years, I mean, probably more so than a lot of programs ever envisioned, and, you know, good, bad, and different. But again, kudos to your team and a lot of the accomplishments and successes you've had. Still a lot of work to be done. What are you looking to accomplish over the next year or two?
Over the next 2 years, we intend to have two milestone Cs, one for the future weapon systems, the MATIS on the JLTV, and for the L-MATIS, which was is on the ultralight tactical vehicle. We intend to certify the MREC prototype for deployment. And then we also intend to finish the deployment of our iCounter Small US system as a USON to the bases that it's scheduled for, and moving that to a program as a service. Right. And so quite a few things across the next 2 years. It's going to be very busy. There's no rest for the wicked.
Listen, exciting times for GBAT and team. Yep. GBAT and company. When can some of the Marines expect to start getting some of the stuff in their hands? And I may be redundant in nature here, but I know some of them have already gotten them in their hands. But
So under the urgent needs, the Marines for the MUSE already have the L-MATIS, which is on the M-RAZR with the capability.
The UTVs.
The UTVs, correct. UTVs. And then we also have out there at the installations our first systems as a service, but they're not quite fully serviced. So we got the capability out there for that. And then as far as program of record, in FY24, where he had IOC for both LMATIS and MATIS.
Okay.
So those versions will be IOC. By the end of 24, we should have made our decisions on the installations and where we're going, most likely a mm-hmm. service. And by the end of 24, we will have certified the EMRIC system for deployment. And therefore, we should then be on our way to putting EMRIC out there for them to utilize.
Awesome. Well, listen, a lot of great things going on, GBAT. I think I may have to reconsider and join the GBAT team instead of...
Well, I've got a spot for you, Manny.
Listen, Don, first and foremost, I really appreciate you taking the time. Congratulations to you and your team. All the best for future success, because this stuff matters. Everything we do matters, but at the end of the day, I mean, this is getting capability in the hands of Marines so we can, we can take on a threat that's constantly evolving. So thanks for making the time. I know you got a lot of things on your plate, so I'm not going to keep you much longer, but before I let you go, there's something we do here at the show.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a couple of tough questions.
Okay.
You ready for our lightning round?
Sure.
All right. What's your favorite vacation spot?
The Cayman Islands.
Awesome. Well, let's head on south then. What's a TV show, book, movie, or a podcast you'd recommend?
I would recommend people reading the book. It's Saving Nine. Author is Senator Mike Lee, and it's his mm-hmm. book on why nine is the right number of Supreme Court justices.
Oh, interesting. If you weren't doing what you do now, what would you be doing?
I'd be in the Forest Service. I'd be a fish cop.
I thought you were going to say you'd be in trouble somewhere. That works as well.
My mom would hate me if I told you I'd be in jail.
Listen, if you could have any superpower, what would it be?
The ability to wave my hand and people would understand each other and get along, and therefore there'd be no need for war and nobody would have to do this job ever again.
That's pretty deep. I can't touch that one. Listen, Don, it's been great conversation. Continued success.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Well, this concludes another episode of Equipping the Corps. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation today. If so, please take a couple minutes, leave us a review, subscribe, tell your friends about us. Till next time, Manny Pacheco signing off.